the court is back in session. The fourth case on our oral argument docket today is the Cordy Construction Company versus the State of Nevada Board of Regents, case number 80736. Mr. Mead, just as a reminder, this is a 30-minute argument. You have 15 minutes. There was no reply brief, so there's no opportunity for rebuttal. So if you're ready to proceed, we'll get going.
Thank you, Your Honor. I understand that. Your Honor, this is an interesting case. It starts off with the State of Nevada in relation to the Board of Regents of the Nevada System of Higher Education on behalf of University of Nevada, Las Vegas, which I am going to short to be UNLV in this matter, entered into a project development agreement with an entity called University Park LLC to develop a university-related multi-purpose facility, primarily as housing for its students and other faculty. The property on which it was built was purchased for $20.5 million. Through the public-private partnership with UNLV contributing $18.5 million and University Park providing $2 million. University Park was given a lease, long-term lease on the property grounds with a credit of that $2 million in prepaid base rent for the project. The lease was assigned to a wholly owned subsidiary of University Park called UPA1. UPA1 holds the property as its sole asset and operates it. The lease required UPA1 to tear down the existing buildings and improvements and to construct what is now known as the Degree, which is a multi-story apartment-styled student housing project. It also contains other amenities that go along with that, a gym, swimming pools, other things of that nature, and has some limited commercial projects. That was going to be entirely constructed by UPA1 at their cost and expense. However, what's important for this court to recall is that upon the substantial completion of those improvements, title to those improvements vested in UNLV. UNLV did not pay any funds towards the construction of the project and has not since that time. UNLV receives over $220,000 a year in rent for that facility. The project as laid out in the lease is to be, quote, held out to the public and potential residents as an integral part of UNLV's on-campus housing stock, like other on-campus housing facilities. The project was not performed as a public work under NRS 338, but rather as a public-private partnership, as I said, as part of UNLV's master campus plan. There are questions of fact as to whether or not that was proper, but that isn't necessarily an issue before this court on this particular matter. As I said, other than their contribute to the purchase of the project, they have not provided anything to the construction of the work. They do, however, receive substantial benefit from that work, including the work performed by Cordy, for which Cordy has not been paid. Now, UP1, pursuant to its lease obligation.
Mr. Mead, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. What evidence is there that a benefit was conferred on UNLV?
Well, Your Honor, very, very simply, the fact that they own title to the property, having not paid for any of it, is certainly a benefit. Beyond that, it falls into part of their master plan. It's used as part of their, as we said, their on-campus facilities. The students and other faculty members are able to use that as part of that plan. And while UPA1 does manage and operate that and charge those persons rent, no doubt that UNLV benefits from that project. Cordy provided at the end of the day a little over $38 million worth of work to the project. After a number of machinations, that lien, that amount, the amount owed has been reduced to just under $3 million. But nevertheless, Cordy is still owed those funds. I believe that that is...
Mr. Mead, this is Justice Herndon in Las Vegas. Along the lines of what Justice Kadish was asking about in terms of benefit to the property owner, didn't we in our Bauer case, however, state that any enrichment to the property owner is not unjust if the contractor can exercise their lien rights, which you all did in this case, and actually there was a bond posted, you know, over 1.5 times the lienable amount here?
Well, that's an interesting question. The Bauer case was decided in 1978, first of all, long before the significant change to Nevada's mechanics lien rights in 2003-2005, where this court has articulated that the public policy of the state of Nevada is to ensure that contractors are paid. And in the Bauer case, yes, it is true that the court it's a one-page case. It's got exactly one paragraph of analysis. It does not get into the analysis of the version of NRS 108.238 that existed at the time. And it simply is a statement that any improvement would be unjust. The most important issue, however, in that case is that the owner of the property that was sought to be charged with unjust enrichment actually paid the general contractor for the project nearly 100% of the cost of that work. That is not the case here. UNLV has not paid a red cent for this work, and Cordy accordingly has performed its work. I think under those circumstances and under the current law, it would be different in this situation. At the end of the day, and we can cut down to the chase, at the end of the day, what is this case really about? The case is about what is a mechanics lien and what does it do? A mechanics lien is nothing more than security for the underlying debt. And I would offer to the court that the vast majority of mechanics lien cases, actually the underlying debt is unjust enrichment. It is the small number that there is an underlying contract that deals with the lien charge. And in fact, almost always in a situation where there's a tenant improvement, there is a contract between between the general contractor and the tenant, and a contract between the landlord and the tenant, but no contract between the tenant and the landlord, contractor and the landlord. Nevertheless, the court finds that, the statute has been enacted to give those without those contracts a right of lien. But what is the right of lien? It is nothing more than security for the debt. And you can see that in a number of ways. First of all, NRS 108.238 specifically says that the mechanics lien statutes may not be interpreted to affect the right of a lien claimant to recover on the debt from the party that owes the debt. And I would submit to the court that the term debt is not limited to contract to a written contract, but in fact is such a black letter law, it is also encompasses the idea of a quasi-contract or unjust enrichment debt. More than that, when you have a mechanics lien and there are subcontractors on the project, there's only one direct contract, the general contractor to the owner, but the subcontractors all have the identical right as well. And the court can look at the substance of mechanics liens by looking at a couple of different places. First of all, under 108.238, there really aren't too many cases that actually interpret that particular provision. But the court has looked at a similar provision, which is found in 108.2275, subsection 7. And this is the statute that allows the removal of a mechanics lien, whether it's frivolous or is excessive. And in that case, this court, in the JD Construction versus Ibex case, said that that provision indicates that the mechanics lien is severable from the underlying debt. And in that particular instance, where you have a decision under 108.2275 that removes the mechanics lien as being frivolous, it has no issue preclusion effect on the underlying case for the contract debt. And so what's the difference here? Well, the difference here is what's being argued is that because the lien was bonded around, which is clear that Cordy had the right to a mechanics lien against UNLV at the time, and also the tenant improvement of the leasehold interest of UPA 1, that was bonded around. What happens to the underlying debt? Well, it doesn't just go away in the underlying debt against unjust enrichment.
Mr. Mead, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City again. So my question then is, whatever amount is ultimately determined to be due, Cordy, if anything, is recoverable against the bond. So, and the party that Cordy had the contract with is in the case. So why does there need to be an equitable claim against UNLV when, you know, your client has a complete remedy available to it, and typically equitable remedies are only when there isn't another remedy available?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, thank you for the question. First of all, we're allowed to have inconsistent pleadings and claims if need be.
Right.
But leaving that aside, your question is an excellent one. Here's the reason. The bond merely being security for the mechanics lien is not perfect. UNLV has said that if we prevail on the underlying claim, we can prevail on the bond. That isn't necessarily true. There can be problems with the claim on the bond, specifically if there is, and I don't think any of these may exist, but it's possible that a notice was not given, that there was some deficiency in the process of securing the mechanics lien. All of those are preserved. The only thing that happens when the bond is put out there is that the underlying property is released from the impact to title by the lien, and that lien attaches to the bond by security. That's very clear under 108.2415, subsection 6A. It just substitutes security. And in that situation, you can have a situation where you lose on the lien, but you prevail on the underlying contract, or in this case, the underlying unjust enrichment case. It is not true that because somebody bonds around a mechanics lien that you now have an adequate remedy in law. That may be true, but it's not in every case. And certainly you don't find that out until you try the entire case. But even beyond that, unjust enrichment is such that even if it's found that Cordy shouldn't get a certain number of dollars under the breach, UNLV can still be unjustly enriched, and Cordy may be entitled to recovery on some form or fashion under that equitable theory. So the lien, the bonding around of the mechanics lien is really somewhat of a red herring. It deals with the property, and UNLV is free to do whatever it wants with its property, but that bonding around also secures the unjust enrichment claim that Cordy has against the property by operation of law, in equity. So, and that's really where it is. And like the Bauer case, the argument came back that well, there is a contract between Cordy and UPA, and there's a contract between UPA and UNLV, but there's no contract between Cordy and UPA. Well, and UNLV. Well, that's exactly lease partners, direct on point. And how we can say that the contract that exists between Cordy and UPA somehow eliminates the ability to obtain equitable relief under unjust enrichment against UNLV, it does not follow lease partners. That is a complete deviation. And the issue about whether or not Cordy knew about UNLV's existence really doesn't have much bearing. There are issues of fact over that, which we provided. The court didn't seem to address that, just assume that we knew and put that in the order. But Nevertheless, that really isn't a major factor. Yes, Lease Partners mentions that, you know, there was no knowledge of who the owner of the property was. But beyond that, there's no analysis. None. That fact is never mentioned again in the case. So it's hard to imagine how that is such a significant factor, and how the fact that you that Cordy knew in this case is such a draconian change to distinguish Lease Partners. Beyond that, you know, then we get into what we've just been talking about. Now, the other case that they mention is the National Bank of Nevada, or excuse me, Nevada National Bank versus, I think it's Snyder. And in that case, I think you can see readily why there would be no unjust enrichment. The bank made a loan for the purchase of the property of $3 million got into exchange security. And for that reason, there was no unjust enrichment. The bank had paid what it was supposed to do. In this case, yes, UNLV has a lease, and they have operated under the lease. But again, they haven't paid anything to UPA One for the construction work that has begun. Cordy has not been paid, and as a result, they have been unjustly enriched. And I see as my time's expired, I would just say that there are issues of fact. We were asking for additional discovery to find out what additional benefits may be there. We were denied that. Discovery was just beginning in this case when summary judgment was entered. So we believe it should.
Mr. Mead, this is Justice Hardesty.
Yes, sir.
I have just one question. Does the record show that your client provided a pre-lien notice to UNLV as part of the 108 chapter perfection requirements?
No, Your Honor, the record does not show that. However, it is true that during the course of the project, UNLV did know that Cordy was on the project and knew what was going on. They provided the bond, the permit, and there were other issues there. So, again, yes, there are questions of fact as to what Cordy knew and when, but we will be able to demonstrate that there was actual notice to the landlord in this case.
Thank you. You've answered my question. Thank you. Ms. Alexander, if you'd like to proceed.
Thank you. I'm going to start with the Leasehold Partners case that was mentioned because Cordy relies heavily upon it and does grossly overstate the scope of that case. Lease Partners does not compel or even warrant the result that's sought by Cordy. In Lease Partners, this court adopted the principle that an action based on a theory of unjust enrichment is not available where there's an express written contract, because no agreement can be implied where there's an express agreement. That's at page 755. And the court found that while there was a written contract between the lessee and the owner, between the finance company, which was Lease Partners, and the lessee, there was no written contract as, quote, contemplated, end quote, by either the Lipschey case or the Amger citation that was included in the court's opinion. And so the question is, what kind of contract then is contemplated by Lipschey or Amger? And it's not defined by either source, but the facts in Lease Partners do provide us insight. In Lease Partners, there was four parties involved. There was the property owner, the Brooks Trust. There was the lessee, which is Danzig. That was the property that leased the hotel from the owner. There was the contractor, Ad Art. They made the sign for which payment was sought. Then there was the financing company, which is Lease Partners. And it was a third-party finance company that provided long-term financing to the lessee, Danzig, for the sign, because the cost of the sign exceeded $800,000. And in Lease Partners, this court held that a written contract referenced in the Lipschey case that prevents recovery for an unjust enrichment claim did not exist because there was no relationship between the lessee's finance company, Lease Partners, and the property owner. But Lease Partners was a complete stranger to the underlying transaction. It was not involved in the beginning when Danzig leased the property from the owner. In fact, it was brought in after the fact simply as the financing vehicle to pay for the improvements. Concluding that Lease Partners would be barred from recovering for money it provided because of another unrelated contract to which it had no knowledge caused this court to overturn the lower court and hold that the claim could be barred simply on that ground. But the factual scenario in Lease Partners is very different from the case at bar. Here, there's only three parties. We've got the property owner, UNLV. We've got the lessee, which is UPA, and we've got the contractor, which is Cordy. And those three parties knew of each other. They knew their roles from the inception. UNLV's interest as a property owner was recorded prior to Cordy entering into the construction contract with UPA. It was recorded in the Clark County Recorder's Office. As just indicated, UNLV, because it was a state project, had to pull the permits. The contractor could not do that, nor could the developer. Had to actually pull the permits for the project. And UPA provided evidence in its joinder to the motion for summary judgment that property ownership was known to Cordy independent of the ownership recording in Clark County. But despite that knowledge, Cordy entered into a contract with UPA in which Cordy's only source of payment would be UPA. Cordy is not a stranger to the or a third party to the project like in lease partners. Rather, Cordy was fully aware of the obligations of the parties prior to signing its contract, and it availed itself to multiple avenues of recovery. Further, there's no dispute that the construction contract between Cordy and UPA is anything but a valid contract that governs the terms of Cordy's services, it governs the payments thereon, and it is the subject of the underlying action that is still ongoing. In its analysis, the district court correctly distinguished between the facts and lease partners relating to whether an outside third party was barred from bringing a claim for unjust enrichment based on an unrelated predated contract in this matter, where Cordy had full bargaining power, was aware of the relationships of the party, and was a signatory to the contract at issue. The district court held that the construction contract between Cordy and UPA precluded unjust enrichment against UNLV because the contract was contemplated. And why was it contemplated? Well, it was because the contract provided for Cordy's rights. Cordy was an active participant in its negotiations. It benefited from that contract. It performed pursuant to the contract, and it relied upon it. And because that contract covered Cordy's foreseeable damages, equitable relief was simply not available to Cordy. The district court correctly applied lease partners and did not err when it concluded that Cordy's unjust enrichment claim was precluded by the construction contract. One last point I want to make about the lease partners case is that it only stands for the proposition that the existence of a contract with a different party does not automatically bar an unjust enrichment claim. So even if a court follows the reasoning in lease partners, and even if a court finds the construction contract is not the type of contract contemplated by Lipschitz, so that Cordy's claim for unjust enrichment is not automatically barred, it doesn't mean that the converse is true. It doesn't mean that Cordy somehow automatically prevailed on its own. It simply means that the court must analyze elements of unjust enrichment and apply the facts of the case to those elements. And here, that's exactly what the lower court did as well. And it ruled that Cordy could not prevail on its unjust enrichment claim also because it had adequate remedies at law. Cordy takes the position that whether or not a benefit was conferred on UNLV must be contemplated by the lower court because Cordy claims that the conferring of a benefit is a question of fact that presents summary judgment ruling. But what Cordy ignores in saying that is that the lower court rightfully analyzed the elements of unjust enrichment and determined that Cordy's allegations could not be proven without ever having to consider or decide whether or not a benefit was conferred on UNL. And Cordy has acknowledged this. It's acknowledged this outcome in its opening brief at page 8. It says that UNLV also argued in its motion for summary judgment that it did not receive a benefit from Cordy's work because UPA challenged the quality of that work, but the district court, quote, made no determination on these issues. What the district court did, as I said, was looked at the underlying case, and the operative case is the Certified Fire versus Precision case, which holds that unjust enrichment exists when these things are present. The plaintiff confers a benefit on the defendant. Defendant appreciates the benefit. Defendant accepts and retains the benefit. And that all of that occurs under circumstances that would be inequitable for the defendant to retain the benefit without having to pay value. And all four of these elements must be met. And the failure to meet even one of these parts means that the claim simply cannot succeed. And it's this last element that we need to focus on. It's the inequities in Cordy bringing an unjust enrichment action against UNLV, given its adequate remedies at law, which is what moved the court to rule as it did. Cordy claims that the district court's ruling was premature because Cordy was permitted to pursue alternative remedies against different parties, and that Cordy, muses also that it is possible that Cordy could be found to confer a benefit on UNLV by reason of the project improvements, and yet for a technical legal reason, Cordy is not able to recover on the mechanics lien release bond. This is simply a hypothetical, and in Cordy's hypothetical, if anything, it just simply further demonstrates the tenuousness of its position. Cordy implicitly concedes that in virtually any scenario, the bond posted by UPA will be an adequate remedy. At the conclusion of the still proceeding underlying case between Cordy and UPA, which is set for trial next month, either Cordy will prevail on its merits, and in which case it will be assured a full recovery on the bond that's been posted, or Cordy will lose, and in that case, it could not have established the required elements for unjust enrichment regardless. So the only alleged circumstance that Cordy can claim that it can recover against UNLV in the presence of the bond that's been posted is some unspecified, vague, technical legal reason for which we have no support, and Cordy does not even speculate about what the reason could be. Given that Cordy will be able to fully recover on any judgment it receives, it is not inequitable for UNLV to have no payment obligation to Cordy under an unjust enrichment claim. In addition to any contract claims, Cordy, of course, had mechanics lien rights under NRS Chapter 108. And as we heard, they provide a revenue of independent, an avenue of recovery independent of a contract claim for work performed on a construction project. It's undisputed, it's in the record, that Cordy initially recorded a lien in April of 2017 for over $20 million. It subsequently amended it two times, reducing it to $2.8 million in December of 2018. A bond, which is statutorily required, is required to be 1.5 times the amount of the lien, which it was, and it was posted and recorded in October of 2018. Thereafter, on October 9th of 2018, Cordy filed its second amended complaint, and it dismissed the claims against the lien and brought claims directly against the bond. The district court held that the mechanics lien bond precluded Cordy's unjust enrichment claim as it exceeded the amount of the claim by Cordy for its services, and therefore provided Cordy with an adequate remedy of law. And this is that relevant element of unjust enrichment claim that I mentioned earlier, the fourth one that is in the certified fire protection case, that under the circumstances, it would be inequitable for the defendant to retain the benefit. But assuming arguendo that there was a benefit conferred to UNLV, it is not inequitable to preclude Cordy from pursuing the unjust enrichment claim, as there is an operative contract to which it is a party and which provides for payment to Cordy, and also because there's a bond that's far in excess of the $2.8 million. And so when such recovery is guaranteed, there's no need or room for a decision in equity, and an unjust enrichment claim fails. The Boyer-Davidson case is on point, and as was noted earlier, this case affirms summary judgment in favor of a property owner on a subcontractor's claim for unjust enrichment. And notably, the court made clear that for at least one reason, that one reason for its affirmation was that the subcontractor could have protected itself by exercising lien rights against the property, which is exactly what happened here. That position is also consistent with this court's observations in the California Commercial versus Amadio Vegas case in 2003. And in that case, the court said that NRS 108-222 allows a contractor to seek mechanics lien for labor, materials, overhead, and profit when no contract exists, thereby preventing unjust enrichment. So we also need to remember that UNLV was not the party from whom Cordy ever expected payment. The lease agreement between UNLV and UPA, which puts the obligation to construct solely on UPA, that was reported before Cordy executed its construction contract. And Cordy relied on its contract with UPA and the lien rights for payment on UNLV.
Ms. Alexander?
Yes.
Justice Kadish, just a quick question about the status of the case. Has UPA denied that there's a valid existing contract between it and Cordy? In other words, I understand there may be dispute about the work and whether it breached the agreement, things like that. But is there any argument being made that there wasn't a valid existing contract between Cordy and UPA?
As far as I know, no, but I have been out of the case because this is the only claim that remains. I've not been in the case since then, although I followed the pleadings, but it is my understanding, Cordy, that UPA has not made that case. They're arguing about some of the lien and then the amounts.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. I just was going to wrap it up and say that the district court's decision then should be affirmed as Cordy's remedies at law are adequate and do not make the fact that it cannot recover from UNLV inequitable.
Ms. Alexander, this is Justice Hardesty. In deciding this case consistent with your argument, do you feel that this court needs to clarify the lease partners case and its holding in any respect?
I think the answer to that is yes, but that's because I'm a practitioner and clarity is always something that we like. I think that they're consistent. I think that lease partners was ruled upon because of the situation, the unique situation, which is that this third-party finance company came in later and didn't understand and didn't know of the parties and had no other and didn't have anything else to recover upon. That, I think, as I argued, can be consistent with what we have here because the court used the term contemplated. I think that if the court wanted to say that any contract, any written contract excludes an unjust enrichment claim, it could have said that simply, or it could have said any contract in which the claimant is a party, right? And that would have had that distinction that leasehold partners did, but it didn't. It said contemplate. So what it tells practitioners and what it tells the lower courts is that you have to look at the contract and decide whether or not it fits within the same kind of context of leasehold partners. And that's why I pointed out the differences between the four parties there and the three here and the very drastic differences in the relationship they had and the reliance they had and what they knew and when.
There seems to be a lot more clarity in the Colorado Supreme Court's decision in DCP and in Arizona's Court of Appeals decision in Wang.
And we did cite to those outside sources, understanding that they were not binding necessarily on the court, but as a guidance that yes, that there's clarity in other cases that could be adopted here.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefs. Mr. Mead, Ms. Alexander, thank you very much for your participation in this oral argument today, and the court will be in recess. And this